Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. We are nearing the climax to A Clash of Kings, and Martin is just brilliant at creating high stakes and low stakes and setting them next to each other and making them feel as if they are one tapestry of a larger story. It's a really hard thing to do, and we see that this week with Sansa's quote-unquote coming of age. Here with me to talk about this is Alicia from Wool Shift Dust. Alicia, what would you say your relationship with this particular book is, Clash of Kings?
Let's see. So I started the first season of Game of Thrones, and I can't remember. I think it was actually when Lady got beheaded that I was like, no, I'm going to read all the books first. So I paused watching.
That was the lady beheading was the your instigation.
Yeah, even before.
To,
yeah, even
that
before
was like
Ned.
The hook. Like if I could, just
I mean,
see
it was horrible to me.
Torture.
But yeah.
If I could just see more dogs being wounded.
No, I mean, I'm like the animal loving vegetarian who only adopts rescues. But that was just so horrifying to me. And I think in the way that, and then when the Ned Stark beheading, people were like, "Oh, you didn't even know what you're in for." And I'm like, "Well, better go see." So. Yeah. I can't remember which books were out at that point, but I went and tore through them all in a couple weeks and then caught back up with the show.
Yeah. All right. So do you think that you read this Sansa plot before you saw it on
the screen? Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Although I will say, having revisited this chapter, the show is so in my head.
Yeah,
with
exactly.
Sansa, for me, Sophie Turner is exactly what she looks like, and her relationship with the Hound is exactly what the show depicted. There's a little difference, but the show really does dominate my imagination.
Yeah, well, I had watched the first couple Game of Thrones episodes, so okay, so it's fair that Sansa looks like Sophie Turner to me, but I was just thinking about Sansa plot lines that happen later in the book with like. When the Hound says goodbye and when she and Cersei are hiding. And I was realizing I really picture the scenes from the show. And I have to wonder, what did that look like in my head before I saw the show? It's just like painted over.
So you are a book reader. Clearly you tore through the books and
especially epic fantasy. Yeah.
All right. So yeah, of course, you know, as we would expect from someone who has a Dune podcast and thinking about launching a Star Wars podcast, Wool Shift Dust, if anyone wants to find Alicia online.
Yeah, we're covering Beacon 23 next. So, yes, sci-fi
okay,
as well.
Very good. So, tell me about you and Sansa. Do you find her a divisive character in the fandom, or is it like...
I mean, in the fandom, yes, but I think it's actually the plot line in this book where... Because at first, she's kind of like an annoying little princess brat, you know? And this is where she starts to learn some really hard lessons. Like really, I have to keep remembering while I'm reading this, which this chapter has an event that helps me remember that she's 12 years old at this point. Mm. And yeah, she's really getting the most brutal wake up call possible. But I do identify with her in some ways. Maybe, you know, we both have long red hair and I consider myself a northerner. But also
where are you from originally?
I'm from Philadelphia, so that's not that far north. I've lived in Amsterdam for the last 17 years, going on 18, I guess, actually this spring. And I just like if you look at my backgrounds, you know, it's a lot of Northwestern European, even the Native American side was originally from Nova Scotia. So it's just a lot of like the lore of my family that I was brought up with.
Sure.
But also, you know, she's like torn between she's a Tully living in a Stark's world. And that living between two cultures is always a character archetype I've identified with.
And you're a dog person or a cat person or both?
I grew up with both. I have cats now because it's just easier in the city to, you know, have cats. But yeah, I always grew up with dogs, horses, cats, lizards, fish, you know, gerbils.
Okay, so I know we're not supposed to pit women against each other, but this book totally wants you to either side with Sansa or Arya. At this point,
you know, I'm sure that there's a little less rivalry now that they're apart. But
right.
Do you feel like you were drawn more to Sansa? Or
no. Yeah? I find it like I just see it as the tragedy of sisterhood that they have. They have each other and they don't realize what they had until they lose it, basically, until they're separated for most of the rest of the story. So that does help them maybe appreciate each other a little more later. But I mean, as far as, of course, yeah, I like characters I identify with, and I see different parts of myself in different parts of them. And both of them can be frustrating characters too. So I'm not choosing sides in this one. Sorry.
yeah, I've come to appreciate Sansa more. I've always kind of had a, I guess that first impression, like you said, like bratty princess.
Right.
Initially off-putting.
Yeah.
But I'm starting, you know, in this chapter, it's hard not to sympathize with her. King's Landing is just full of horrible people giving horrible advice.
Yeah.
So, and pretty cruel at times. I mean.
Yeah, I think she goes on one of the most satisfying character arcs of anyone in the entire series.
She could have made you happy for a little while.
There's only one thing that'll make me happy.
And what's that?
That's my fucking business. Used to be you couldn't look at me.
That was a long time ago. I've seen much worse than you since then.
Yes, I've heard. And you were broken in. And you were broken in rough.
And he got what he deserved. I gave it to him.
How?
Hounds.
You've changed, little bird.
All right, we'll talk more about that, but let me read my synopsis here.
Okay.
Sansa's in the Godswood again, but can't escape the smoke from the Kingswood. She has heard that Stannis sent troops to smoke out Tyrion savages. When Dantos arrives, he's drunk again and brings no news again of her escape. He promises her that they have a mutual friend who will spirit her away when the time is right. She dodges his kisses and leaves. She speaks with Sandor Clegane, who tells her that murder is all kinds of fun. Then she flees when he tells her to. That night, Sansa gets her first period. In a haphazard attempt to hide the evidence, she tries to burn her mattress in the hearth. She is taken to Cersei, who tells her that childbirth is painful and love is poison. So, Alicia, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I mean, I guess it's you brought up the point of, you know, she's dodging his kisses. And we also get in this chapter, we see her relationship with the Hound. And it's sort of, she's 12 years old, you know, and she is all this. And of course, Sandor is not nearly as icky about it. Right. But still, it really does bother me how everyone in her life is kind of lecherous. You know, she is a child, she's a preteen.
Yeah.
And that is, I think that's one reason why, other than the early brattiness, that's one reason why people struggle with the Sansa character, because it's just so difficult to watch her go through this.
You know, of all the villains in this book, Dantos doesn't get the credit he deserves. He's pretty horrible. And, you know,
he gets his just desserts.
That's right. In the end, it doesn't work out great for him. But he's a scoundrel, and he's pretending to be a knight. Mm-hmm. He's pretending to be chivalrous, probably at Peter Baelish's, instigation. Yeah. But, you know, it's not like the Hound is a paragon of virtue. Or
no, yeah, just by contrast.
Just by those two are set in contrast in this chapter. But Dantos is, you use the word lecherous as a good word. That really struck me in this chapter. Like, this guy is not her friend, and he's probably just some kind of tool of Littlefinger, but he doesn't have to try to kiss a 12-year-old.
No.
He certainly doesn't have to do that. And he's drunk, and he's probably self-serving in the end. And I just, you know, and this chapter just got me thinking about how horrible Dantos is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, you know, the fact that she gets her period in this chapter also really just makes it hit home about how young she is. And of course, yeah, there's a whole other horror of Joffrey, who's just actually a psychopath. That's even worse.
Right. Joffrey's shadow kind of looms over this chapter.
Yeah.
Sweet Child of Time is a podcast that has recapped every episode of 1899, Dark, and The Wheel of Time. And we will be recapping Season 3 of Wheel of Time as it airs. Join me, Steve Barnes of the band Introvoid, and my roster of co-hosts, including film critic Lindsay Dunn, as we recap our favorite TV shows and movies related to time, including Time Bandits, Death Clock, and more. Sweet Child of Time on Spotify, Apple, everywhere podcasts are. Check us out, Sweet Child of Time.
10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
You know, if you ever go to a middle school. That is the age where kids are kind of at their worst. And, you know, he's being told that, he's already a bully, and he's being told that it's his divine right to bully in the most egregious ways that he mm-hmm. can think up. And Sansa is just basically his favorite toy. And that's what she's being told she is at this impressionable age. So it's kind of remarkable that by the end of this all, she emerges as, you know, a relatively level-headed leader.
So it's all right. So this is interesting to me because there are very few people who are actually trying to rein in Joffrey.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he is a boy king, and you would imagine, and, you know, just talking with people who study this period, usually what they say is there's usually some adult in charge when there's a child king. But you get the sense here that, you know, Tyrion's in charge, but not really having much interaction with Joffrey right. or trying to train him or school him. You know, you've got the Hound who's kind of doing his bidding. I don't think Maester Pycelle is very effective in this way. and
he wouldn't even try.
That's right. And then when we meet Cersei at the end of the chapter, she's very cynical, you know?
Right.
I think she's sort of like resolved to think, my son's kind of a monster. You're going to have to live with it.
I'm sure that part of her thinks that she's doing Sansa a favor by teaching her, how cruel this world is to women. Because that's what Cersei is known.
Yes. Yes. I mean, but couldn't... I mean, I'm just wondering, like...
Although, of course, it's much worse for Sansa, who, doesn't have... she has a loving brother, but not anywhere nearby. And not in the same way, obviously.
You know, people love Tyrion, and I love Tyrion, too. But he's really neglecting this part of his job. I feel like he should be taking Joffrey under his wing and saying, look, here's what I'm doing. Here's how I'm thinking through this scenario. Here's how I'm preparing for battle. These are all things that you're going to have to learn if you want to be a good king. And, by the way, here's how you should be perceived by your subjects. And you should never be cruel. And all of these things that, Robert never did with Joffrey, this is what Tyrion should be doing. Now,
who is Joffrey going to listen to? I feel like Jaime should be the one stepping in this way, to be honest.
Jaime, unfortunately, is in the bowels of River Run. Jaime, for all
Well,
of his...
I mean, I just mean in general in Joffrey's life growing up.
Yes, right. Yeah, for all of his knightly virtues.
Chivalry,
supposed
chivalry.
Jaime is kind of a shitty father.
Yeah.
Let's just say, in general, Lannisters do not produce good fathers.
No.
This is
and by
problem.
The way, I do know people who intensely dislike Tyrion, too. So.
Oh, you do? I haven't met these people. Okay. I mean, it's definitely a worthy argument to be made. I mean.
Yeah, especially later. But
I'm
definitely
sure.
on the pro-Tyrion side.
It's hard not to like him because he's funny and he's smart, right?
Right.
That kind of covers over a number of other sins.
Failings,
But it wouldn't take much to convince me that this guy is the ultimate villain of the entire series.
Yeah. He does kill people, including his girlfriend, so.
He kills people for sure. So I was going to call out some of the advice that Sansa gets in this chapter.
Okay.
Dantos tells her, calls her clever, and then says, she says, well, actually, the king and the king's mother say that I'm stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, that's not bad. You should.
Right.
You should allow them to think that you're stupid.
Well, he knows that more than anyone as a fool.
Right. Yeah. He says he overhears lots of stuff now that he's a fool that they would have never said in front of him as a knight. Then what does the Hound say? The Hound says, there are no gods, just like there are no true knights.
Mm.
And, your father was a lord and he probably never told you this, but killing is actually quite sweet. It's quite a sweet
thing. I do not think that Ned Stark thinks that.
Right. And then Cersei basically says, you're not going to love my son, but you're going to love his children. Mm-hmm. And also be very cautious when it comes to love, because love is poison. She says it's sweet poison, but it's deadly. And so I'm wondering what you think of these three. It's almost like we have a little Greek chorus on the side.
Right. Of cynicism.
Right. So I'm wondering what you think about these three bits of advice.
I mean, having these highlighted, it does make me think about what a cynical story this is overall. Mm-hmm. Just thinking, you know, how the show ends. We know that that's how George R. R. Martin at least intended to end the books. But I think that, yeah, she's not getting enough counter advice, which is why it's so remarkable that she doesn't turn out to be a horrible villain. Like, this is a villain origin story. But somehow,
yeah, I'm not sure that she won't have sort of an episode of villainy later in the books. I mean, Martin does that from time to time with, you know, he'll turn someone like Jaime into someone heroic, and he'll turn someone like Tyrion into a villain. And so I wouldn't put it past Martin to make Sansa into Cersei's image at one point.
And then realize.
And then, you know, maybe she arcs back. This does look like a villain's origin story here.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't be able to completely blame her if she did that, but I also hope, if it happens, that it's a learning experience and definitely doesn't stick, because I would find it is a villain origin story, but it's so paint by numbers villain's origin story, that it's more interesting if she somehow ends up in a better place.
Well, if you think about her mentors, you know, Cersei, and then eventually it's Baelish, and the Hound a little bit, in terms of like telling her the way the world really is. So you think about all those characters, she could easily take their advice in a number of different ways, right?
So, yeah, I mean, but I think also maybe the saving grace for her is who it comes from. And it comes from, with the possible exception of Sandor, it comes from people who she doesn't respect. Mm-hmm. So that definitely makes it carry less weight. And maybe even at some point in her brain says, if people who I think are not good are saying these things, then maybe they're not true.
Hmm. Do you think that she doesn't respect Cersei?
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say doesn't respect, but doesn't think she's a good person. I don't think she any longer wants to emulate her.
Hmm.
She's definitely
afraid of her, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, she kind of has vacillated a bit on... Well, let me back up again. So, well, let's take the first bit of advice. It's okay. It might be useful for the people at court to think that you're stupid. That might
right.
be
advantageous. That's actually good advice.
I think it is too. I think, you know, Dantos, for all of his lecherousness, that is actually not bad advice, given her place at court.
Right.
He also says, you know, other things like, you know, of course there are gods. The gods sent me to you and I'm here to help you and all of that business, which I don't think that she should trust.
No.
And
it's interesting reading this, remembering reading it the first time and not knowing that it was Littlefinger he was talking about. And not knowing, of course, how badly that turns out for her. And ultimately, it seems, seems like it's better, but then anyway.
Right. All right. So then the Hound offers her advice. Basically, I don't know. There's something honest about what he's saying. I think he's kind of horrible. He's definitely cruel and scare her.
He's less cruel.
Well, okay. So this is interesting. She doesn't think she's going to fall, but this is like probably the fourth time he has helped her from falling in this in these books. When she first meets him, she sees Ellen Payne, is afraid of him, and steps backwards and trips over something. And she thinks that it's her father who steadies her, like a hand keeps her from falling backwards, and it's the Hound who scares her even more. Then this happens on the steps in another part of the book, and then in this chapter she's recalling the riot. And, you know, the man with the garlic breath tries to pull her off the horse. Right. And then she feels like...
Great sensory detail to put you
Yeah, in. That's right. And then the hand gets lopped off and she feels a stronger hand push her back up into the saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this chapter, Sandor helps her. You know, she might fall off the battlements or, you know, some high place.
The roof,
Yeah, okay, yeah. And she says she's not going to fall, but he steadies her and scares her simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a repeated thing in this chapter. And I wonder if that's, is that just a nice little motif, or do you feel like that is saying something more? Is it a metaphor?
I mean, I think he's one of the most interesting characters in the story because he is... very much a morally gray character, maybe one of the most morally gray characters, along with maybe Varys.
Mm-hmm.
And this, where you first see, you basically the goodness that you see in him is how he treats Sansa and later Arya. And maybe it's sort of, in a way, she's keeping him from falling.
Interesting.
Like all the things that, you know, her... more errant knights that the, you know, she wants, there's someone she wants to be a knight for her. And then this person who says, I am never a knight, you know, call me, I'd rather be called a dog than a knight.
Right.
But you have the echoes of, well, but I want to be better because I see you and I want to help you. And that makes me think more about the morality of your situation, about the situation in general. And yeah.
Say more about her helping him.
Well, I mean, I think just by him being driven by this, that he empathizes with her. He sees her as, you know, his little bird. And he, by wanting to help her, it makes him think more about what he's doing in the name of the Lannisters.
Interesting. So she, because she is a damsel in distress...
Yeah, I hate the trope, the but option. There it is.
Right, yeah, it's there. He has the option to act in noble ways, whereas if she was self-sufficient, he could just be a dog all the time.
Yeah, although, you know, later he meets with Arya, who's arguably one of the most self-sufficient characters, and he's still, maybe because she's Sansa's sister even, he ultimately... wants to, she also makes him want to be a better person.
Is that true? I think maybe you're right about that. I think that there's something about his, like we're talking about larger arcs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, not in this chapter specifically, although I see the glimmer of it here. I think this is where it sparks.
So interestingly, in this chapter, he has a little theological statement that, you know, there are no gods, just like there are no true knights. But then he, if we buy the grave digger hypothesis, which I do, he ends up kind of falling in with a religious order later on in the books. And I don't know if he ever changes his mind. Maybe he is just sort of a place for him to land. But it is an interesting thing that he maybe is on the path to becoming a true knight.
Mm-hmm.
And this also has a religious dimension for him.
Yeah. I mean, I can see why maybe it's not even necessarily about like worshiping gods, but just having that respite from, you know, the society, the toxic society in which he's always lived and moved, and trying to listen to himself within more and figure out, does he want to be this person, this attack dog?
Yeah. So what about his advice? What do you think? Do you think that this is good advice he's giving her?
I mean,
You should know that men like killing people. I don't know. That might be a good thing for a future queen to know.
Yeah, but I don't think he's right about her father. I don't think that Ned liked killing people. I think that he really did it out of duty, and I think that he felt very badly about it. And I would hate for her to think that that lack of empathy is normal.
Hmm. That's interesting.
But I think, yeah, she's getting the double team of it from Cersei also, who's like, well, yeah. If Cersei were there on that rooftop, she would also be nodding along with Sandor.
All right. That might be true. Maybe Ned is honorable when it comes to that. But this is something that Tyrion knows, which is why he keeps Bronn around, right? It's like,
right.
This may be immoral, but it might be useful at times to have someone who's willing to get his hands dirty if you're going to survive in King's Landing. I kind of feel like if you're going to be in that role, you may need to know how to use certain tools in certain ways.
Right.
And so it may be helpful for her to know, like, there are people like Sandor Clegane in the world, and I better know how to use them if I'm going to be a political mover and shaker.
Yeah, I guess the inner idealist in me is like, well, we don't want to use people. we befriend them and we ally with them.
Well, okay, that's interesting. So in terms of sort of a literary move here, you know, she loses Lady, right? So mm-hmm. she no longer has
I'll
her
never get
wolf.
Over that.
But what she doesn't realize is that she's lost her wolf, but she's gained a dog.
Mm.
And so
yeah. She can't warg, though, like the rest of her family.
She cannot, unfortunately, warg into Sandor Clegane, which would be nice if you ever wanted to dispatch of Joffrey. But if you look at it in that way, and I think we're meant to look at it this way, it's like, actually, he's kind of an asshole about it, but he is on her side. And he does, you know, he does try to save her. He does try to save her from falling. I think
he saves her from the crowd. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So he is more her dog, I believe, than Joffrey's dog.
Yeah.
Although I don't think that she sees it that way.
No. I mean, I think she, at this point, people she trusted, she just learned that they're all kind of evil. So she doesn't know who to believe, who to trust.
All right, Cersei's advice.
Yeah, well, love is poison.
Love is poison. You're not going to love Joffrey, but you're going to love his children. Do you think, I mean, clearly, again, cruel, but is it good advice?
I mean, what's the advice in there? It's to just submit to this situation.
Never fall in love is the advice.
I mean, don't fall in love with Joffrey, but I think she's learned that. I do think, yeah, that it's right that she would probably love their children, but then what kind of children would he warp them into if he is the dominant one who is probably also as violent with them as he is with her?
I think that this is a bigger commentary on love in Martin's books. I think Cersei, in the same way that Cersei gets the line, you either win the Game of Thrones or you die. I think in this book, she gets a very important line. That is that love is poison. It's sweet, but it's deadly. And I think this is a major theme in Martin's books.
Are there any happy couples in the end in his books? Because I am not thinking, none are springing to mind. There's a time where many of them are happy, but
I think in this series in particular, Song of Ice and Fire, anyone who pursues love is punished.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right after she says that, we jump to the next chapter, who, you know, which is Jon. And John has just met Ygritte. And I think, again, there's the theme. In Martin's books, if you pursue romantic love, the world will punish you. And I think that Cersei gets this line because it's true in Martin's world. I don't know. I don't think it's true in life, but it's an important lesson for Martin's characters to know.
But isn't it, Rich? I mean, I guess Cersei knows because obviously she didn't marry the man she loved, but she still has the man who she loves in her bedroom all the time. So it's kind of rich coming from her.
This is interesting. Does she really love Jaime? I know that Jaime really loves Cersei and is devoted to her and, you know, in his way, you know, more honorable than Ned Stark because whatever. That's what he says in a few chapters later. But does Cersei's feelings for Jaime, are they, can we characterize her feelings for Jaime as love?
I mean, some sort of love. I think for Cersei in her life, it probably goes number one, her children, number two, herself, number three, Jaime, number four, anyone else.
Interesting.
Distant number four.
I could probably get on board with that. I just, there's a little part of me that thinks he definitely loves her children.
Mm-hmm.
Is she too cynical? Or is she too beaten down by, you know, the world of Southern politics to actually return Jamie's? I mean, she's not devoted to Jaime. I mean, maybe in her way. Maybe in her way she loves Jaime.
I think she wouldn't want to show the weakness of, you know, and she also, of course, made sure to climb above him. She's queen. He's head of the Kingsguard.
Right. Yeah. One of these interesting questions that requires a little bit more writing for us to have an answer, yeah. Right?
Are you suggesting that another book come?
I wouldn't discourage it. So I would. All right. So you think that Cersei is giving her bad advice?
I think Cersei is. I don't necessarily see it as advice. I mean, I guess the only advice in there is to accept your situation. And I don't think that Sansa should do that. I don't think that Sansa, even if she didn't have Littlefinger pulling strings, I don't think Sansa would ultimately be stuck there as long as she's survived this experience. I think there's always going to be some way or another for her to get out. As a Stark kid, someone's going to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I don't think she should just roll over and accept that. I think that Cersei is just sort of like, well, that was my lot in life. I had to marry someone I didn't love, but, you know, at least I got some good things out of it. So be grateful because that's what I got.
So I want to talk about, I think it's really kind of amazing as this book is definitely nearing the climax of the book. To have a character like Sansa who's has this simple biological moment and have it be like the worst possible. Mm. Like it feels like we've been building to this point.
That's the climax of her story in this book.
In this book, it's like that's the worst possible thing with the worst possible timing. I don't know.
I mean, I remember being horrified when I first read it too, because yeah, that is what that means, that in... I know it's not real medieval, but in medieval times, it's a girl has come of age. She's able to bear children now. So yeah, it makes sense. You know, what's funny though, is so when you asked me to do this, I was like, okay, let me refresh my brain. What exactly happens in this book versus,
yeah.
I always think that like things like the Red Wedding happen earlier than they do, or right. Joffrey dying. So I looked up some recaps of the book just to remind myself. And so I read the one on like a Song of Ice and Fire wiki. And like, I watched a YouTube video. Neither of them even mentioned Sansa in the recap of the book.
Really?
So it's really, it feels like her story in this book to a lot of people, it seems like it's because yeah, the climax of her story is in this book is literally getting her period. And to a lot of people, they're like, well, that's not the important plot, but it is for Sansa as a character. This is maybe definitely one of the most, or at least the beginning of like the pivotal time in her life where she starts to realize she's no longer a sweet summer child.
So in this book, Sansa has 8 POV chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I think that these tend to be on the shorter side.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, she's not the only window into King's Landing, because we've got
we've got
15 Tyrion chapters.
Yeah.
So maybe the more interesting thing to most people is to view the plot of King's Landing through Tyrion's eyes.
Right.
But it's just really unfortunate because, I mean, this chapter has so much in it.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's more subtle. It's more grounded. It's not big battles or, you know. Uh-huh. It's setting up a lot of things to come for her.
I mean, maybe this goes to a sort of like misrepresentation that Sansa has in the fandom. Maybe there's a little bit of misogyny happening here. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you would think if you're going to summarize the book, you at least have to summarize the hairnet that she gets at the end of it, because that's very important in the next book. With the poison amethysts.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, I do have a few other things in mind, but I wanted to give you another opportunity if there's another observation or something you want to talk about related to Sansa.
No, I was just thinking about the fact that she is the only one who doesn't have a wolf, and she's caught in this King's Landing thing. She's more and more cut off from being a Stark, and it is interesting then to later have her go through all this and then later have her injected back into her childhood environment and see what kind of person that makes her, coming as almost an outsider back to where she grew up.
Hmm. So her response to getting her period.
Mm-hmm. Oh, to burn her stuff. I was rooting for her.
She almost, I mean, it's almost like...
It's like the whole bed.
Yeah, I kind of feel like there's nothing to be done. But and maybe that explains it, but she does kind of do the worst possible thing, right? Like, how is she going to explain the fact that she's burning her entire mattress in the fireplace? Yeah. What's the end game here? So, but it does kind of give you the sense that, like, this has pushed her to her absolute limit. She doesn't know what to do. She's acting rashly. She's panicking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was thinking that the shadow of Joffrey hangs over absolutely. This chapter. I mean, that really explains what she does with this. But it really is a moment of, you know, it's not like she's in the bear pit or she's, you know, in Ramsay's torture dungeon or something like that. But it really does affect you. It really does feel like, oh no, this is the worst possible thing that could happen at this moment.
Yeah. And I when it was just like the sheets and stuff, and I was like, okay. But then even if she had burned the sheets and it hadn't been on the mattress, then what's she going to do? How is she going to hide it? I just throughout this entire book, I kept hoping that she would get away. And then of course she gets that chance later with Sandor and says no. And I'm like so frustrated with her because she ends the book still stuck in this place. But of course, yeah, it looks like things get better next one.
Yeah. Yeah. Cersei says something really interesting. It gives a nice little insight into Tyrion's character. She's talking about Robert. She's saying he had the disease where he wanted people to love him. Like he even couldn't be around babies that didn't love him. And then she says something like, my brother Tyrion has the same disease. And I think this is very insightful.
Yeah.
This is his Achilles heel.
But there you have Robert and Tyrion. They have this need for love coming from completely different places, where Robert was told his whole life, you are worthy of love, you're so great, you know, more similar to Joffrey in a way. But so he just needs that constant reassurance that he grew up with. And then Tyrion, on the other hand, he wants love because it doesn't come to him easily. He didn't grow up with it.
I think that Cersei has kind of decided to take this and create armor around herself. Like, she's mm-hmm. decided, I'm not going to be weak like Tyrion. I'm not going to be right. weak like these other women who are below me. I'm right. going
like she
to...
thinks Sansa is.
Yeah, that's right. She thinks, I'm going to shield my heart, and therefore that will create some amount of armor around me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how you have to be a woman in this world.
Right.
And Tyrion has not learned this. You know, he's got ample evidence that the world is a cruel place. But deep down, he actually does still entertain this idea that he could be in a loving relationship.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think in Martin's world, Cersei has taken the wiser path.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because then I feel like one reason why she ends up hating Marjorie Tyrell so much is because she comes in and Marjorie comes in and is somehow able to just be more like she can be herself without, not that she doesn't have cynicism, but she can do it in a warmer, less cruel way.
Hmm.
And people like her all the more for it. And then Cersei maybe starts to realize then, which is after the point we're talking about now, that maybe she didn't have to harden herself quite so much.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know what kind of example she has in her life. I mean,
she
wants to be like Tywin. Tywin mm-hmm. is not necessarily the warmest person you'd ever meet.
No, they grew up on a rock.
That's right. That's right. They're inside of a rock.
They grew up in the High Gardens.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So notable introductions in this. I didn't see any notable introductions. I mean, aside from the key reveal about Sansa's bedsheets or whatever.
Right. Notable introduction. Puberty.
Yep. Sansa's puberty. Notable departures, I guess we could say Sansa's childhood.
Mm.
And then notable departures from the book.
I beg pardon, sir. Okay. I should have come to you after to thank you for saving me. You were so brave.
Brave? A dog doesn't need courage to chase off rats.
Does it give you joy to scare people?
No, it gives me joy to kill people. Spare me. You can't tell me Lord Eddard Stark of Winterfell never killed a man.
It was his duty. He never liked it.
Is that what he told you? He lied. Killing's the sweetest thing there is.
Why are you always so hateful?
You'll be glad of the hateful things I do someday when you're queen. And I'm all that stands between you and your beloved king.
So, a lot of those lines are taken directly from this chapter.
Right.
But the way that the conversation ends seems to go in a different direction. They add that last little bit about, you'll be glad for my hatefulness when I'm all that stands between you and Joffrey.
Mm-hmm.
Suggesting, I guess maybe putting a subtext on the surface. But this chapter is much more dark, I feel like. This chapter, right. She walks away from Sandor thinking he just confessed to murder. He just confessed to liking to murder.
Right.
So there's not even a glimmer of hope in this chapter. Whereas in the dialogue that they have in the show, I think they try to brighten it up a little bit at the end.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, for all the criticism they get for Sansa's character's treatment on the show, first of all, they aged her up, of course, which, you know, thank God. But also, they don't show as much brutality as is described in the book.
Well, but they...
I mean, they...
Her assault like, by the mob is a lot worse.
Right. But in terms of the beatings that Joffrey gives her, it's not... where she has the top half of her dress
right.
torn off.
And, that's right. You know. Uh-huh. But at the end of this dialogue, there's almost like a promise, like, I may be bad, I might be a dog, but I'm a dog that's going to be on your side
right.
when you end up getting married to Joffrey. Mm-hmm. And maybe she doesn't have the ears to hear it because it's sort of like painted so darkly. But to me, that's a little glimmer of hope.
Right.
That the book does not give you.
I mean, I did see hope in his character ever since he saved her from that crowd in the book, even. Yeah. But then, yeah, in both cases, you can understand why she chooses not to go with him later, this book.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, thank you, dude, for helping me. But just the two of us out there on our own, I don't know.
So earlier in this, I think it may even have been the last Sansa POV chapter, she says that she no longer believes in true knights. She believes that knights are scoundrels, just like Sandor Clegane does. But she almost is trying to talk herself back into it in this chapter. You know, she's almost like, Dantos is my Florian.
Right.
And, she, you know, she's trying to tell the Hound that, you know, that there are true knights, you know, knights should protect the weak. So I don't know if it's just something she's trying to tell herself or.
Yeah, I think she has to cling to something.
She's trying to cling to something for sure. Yeah.
And I think for the reader, too, you know, we had to get some bone. Her story is so dark at this point.
That's right.
We had to get some glimmer of hope for her.
Yeah.
I can understand why this is a, as you said, controversial character a bit, just because, and I don't think it's her fault. I think she is a very interesting character, but it is often difficult to read from her perspective. And this isn't even one of the worst chapters, but you can already see here, you know, what she's going through. You're kind of like, oh, just let me get past this painful part and get back to like a more fun part with people who have more agency and power.
I think you're really right about that. I think she's a really important character for describing. Unfortunately, I think that part of the purpose that she serves is to give us insight into the Hound's character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't talk about Baelish very much, but
right. He
really is the voice behind Dantos in this chapter. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is, in retrospect, there is something about Baelish's character that's being revealed here. You know, Dantos is something of a proxy. You know, even when he leans in for the kiss, it's sort of like a proxy for Baelish here. I don't know if we're being, let me ask it this way. Are we being given Sansa in this book as a character to root for or a compelling and interesting character? Or is that something that really doesn't happen till later in the story?
I think, you know, you can't help but root for a little girl caught in this situation. And maybe actually by putting her, because she is annoying at first. I definitely can admit that. And then by putting her in this situation is where she starts to stop being annoying and it starts to turn around. And this is where you first start rooting for her just because she's such the underdog at this point.
Mm-hmm. One other little thing I was going to mention about Sandor is that, you know, he's pretty horrible in this chapter. It's almost like you could, aside from him killing Micah in the first book, this is kind of as villainous as he gets. Because he's sort of on the arc toward heroism, and then you meet him in this chapter and you're like, man, you're just the worst. But I was thinking about that, and I think that there might be something about the fact that there's fires surrounding the city.
Mm-hmm, right.
The force is on fire. Tyrion has lit the fires, and so and he feels like the imminent, you know, danger of the battle, which is going to be all about fire. And I think that there's something about that that has touched a raw nerve.
Absolutely.
He's going to feel backed into a corner when he's in the presence of fire.
As Freud would say, is unlocked his id.
Yes. Very good. Alicia, thank you for helping me cover this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was, I don't want to say it was fun to talk about, but it's, yeah, I do find Sansa a very interesting character to delve into. And I think she gets the short shrift a lot in the fandom.
I agree. And I admit that I certainly gave her the shorter end of the shrift. Where can folks find you if they are interested in hearing you talk about other fantasy epics or sci-fi epics?
Yes, so you can find me on Wool Shift Dust, where that talks about the Silo series, Beacon 23. We're doing a Dune series. You can find me regularly on the Lorehounds. For instance, I've been popping up on Shogun episodes and also the MC Universe there. And in May, watch out for a new Star Wars Complete Timeline Order podcast, which will be starting. We'll be skipping a little through the Old Republic and High Republic to set up for full coverage of the Acolyte, and then going from there, going through Star Wars in timeline order.
Oh, that's fun.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
And, MC Littlefinger is all about doing whatever he can to move his own agenda along.
Yeah, Littlefinger seems to be doing pretty well.
He gets Harrenhal, right?
He gets Harrenhal, which
has just seen better days. It's seen better days.
It's a fixer-upper.
Yeah. Buy low.
Right. And he gets all the lands around it forever. Mm. Forever. So that's kind of a big deal. In addition to that, he's been able to get on the good side of both the Lannisters and the Tyrells. And for some reason, he can't keep his eyes and personage off Sansa. That's what he like. Yeah, I got a castle. That's great. Got lands. That's great. Made this alliance. But what I really care about is being a little bit creepy in a conversation with Sansa. I need that. That's what I need in my day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to tell with Littlefinger. Is this ultimately a bargaining chip for him and his relationship with Lady Catelyn? Or is this a Lady Catelyn proxy?
I often wondered that. I feel like I never really knew whether or not he was sort of wanting to get revenge. Because, back in the day, he pursued Catelyn, and Ned's brother cut him from chin to navel or whatever.
Right.
So maybe he wants revenge for that. Or maybe he's just greedy and he thinks, this is an asset. Or maybe he's thinking, at the end of the day, I'm going to get back with Catelyn. I'm going to make sure her husband dies. I'm going to get on the good graces of her daughter. And eventually I'm going to win this woman that I love.
No, or he's just Hornhorn.